to be here to give this lecture. I apologize, but my voice is a little scratchy. I had a cold last week, and I thought it would be all gone by now, but it's not. So I'll try to make my diction as clear as I can. So I'm from the Institute for Quantum Computing down the road. And my understanding is that that you guys already know quantum physics. And I'm supposed to give you some perspective on quantum, maybe you know more than I do about it, about quantum information. And is that right? Okay. And anyway, you feel free to kind of push some kind of fast forward button if you feel that I'm covering something that most people know or something. I've got lots of slides, and I have other packs of slides, so I can change gears if necessary, or I can go slower if necessary. Questions are welcome at any time. So why don't, without further ado, so there's this basic framework of quantum information, and I guess what I want to say, let me go back, is that I'm going to talk about quantum information, but without the physics. And that may seem like a strange thing to do, but something like this happened in computer science. And I'm a computer scientist. It used to be many decades ago that computer science was viewed as some subfield of electrical engineering. And then it was electronics. And then it eventually there became this this perspective that you can sort of divorce the software from the hardware in terms of your focus. It's not to say that the hardware isn't important. It's extremely important. But if I have information, let's say in a USB drive, I don't necessarily have to relearn things if there's a different technology for storing the information, you know, in terms of how much it can be compressed and how efficient certain algorithms are for processing it. So it's sometimes it's helpful to somehow look at things in a more abstract way. And so I want to think about this object called the quantum register. And let's start with classical registers. So these blue boxes are like these, think of these as little USB drives, if you will, but instead of containing, 32 gigabytes, one contains one bit and one contains three bits. And so they have, this can be in two states, zero or one, and this can be in eight different states, any three-bit string. And I'm just drawing it as a box, but I'm assuming you have some physical implementation of this device. And what I really mean is that you can perform certain operations on these devices. And one operation that you would want to perform is you'd want to be able to set the state of one of these registers, like set the bit to zero or set the three-bit register to 101. But if you can't access the information later, that's maybe not going to be very useful. You want to be able to, at some later point, pull out the information. Maybe you want to give this to someone, and then have them, read the information. Maybe there's an important letter that you've written, and you want the party at the other end to access it. So you want to be able to set it and then to read the state. And then there's this other kind of operation, which is a little bit different, which is to process the state. And by this, I mean we might have a bit register, and we might want to, for example, just flip the bit. So if it was a zero, turn it into a one. If it was a one, turn it into a zero. And we might not necessarily care about knowing what the value is. So maybe you hand me this blue box, and then I decide that I want to flip the bit. Or maybe I decide I don't want to flip the bit, but I decide which of the two I want to do, and then I give it back to you. Now, I could do that by reading the state and determining the bit and then setting the state to the opposite state, but I don't necessarily want to do it that way. I might want to just directly be able to process. Okay, so all this stuff is going to come up again in the quantum context. But my first comment is that there's more to the story already in the classical case than this, because we can, without getting into any quantum information, we can consider a probabilistic state. But what I might want to do is actually flip a coin. and set the bit to that. Or I might want to choose some probability between 0 and 1. You know, maybe it's 1 over pi or some other very special number, and then set the bit to be 0 with that probability and 1 with 1 minus that probability. Okay, and the rules are that, you know, with probabilities, that they, for the elementary events, they should be non-negative, and they should, all the probabilities should sum to 1. Okay, this is, well, everything's going to be finite spaces here, and the quantum information will be finite dimensional Hilbert spaces in these lectures. And this may be something that we want to do. And in general, like, for example, for the 3-bit register, you know, the general state could be maybe described as a probability vector where we have 8 probabilities. And actually, people want to do this sometimes, like in cryptographic protocols. Maybe the message that that I send, you know, Alice sends to Bob of her encrypted data is actually randomly generated according to some very specially chosen distribution, and Bob receives that at the other end. So these are different kinds of states in a way, and there's some issues that come up, like setting the state. Because how do we set these states? Well, it's actually maybe a little bit tricky to generate probabilities exactly, but we can get pretty good approximations. Actually, flipping a coin is not a bad way to approximate a random bit. And you can, from that, you can, from several coin flips, you can get other distributions, but maybe you can't get them exactly to perfect precision because there's a whole continuum of different probability values. But you can get it. Reasonable approximation. I mean, in practice, this works, and this is done in algorithms and communication protocols. What does it mean to process the state of one of these registers? Well, the process can itself induce randomness. Really, what you could do, the most general thing you can do is take something that takes the probability vector as input and multiplies it by a stochastic matrix and gives another probability vector. For example, if the bit is 0, maybe you want to then replace it with a random bit. But if the bit is 1, you just want to leave it as 1. You can come up with a 2x2 matrix that corresponds to that, such that you multiply the P0, P1 vector by that matrix, you get this new distribution. And that's the most general thing you can do. Okay. There's this other issue about what it means to read the state. Because you don't get to see the probabilities, right? You only get to see the bits. And so you can make maybe some kind of inference, you know, that if you saw 0, then P0 was not 0. But you don't really know a heck of a lot more. In fact, you only know one bit of information, even though these numbers maybe, you know, can be arbitrary real numbers in the interval 0, 1. So you really don't get you get only a very small amount of information. That's much less than the information that the probability vector contains. If you think of the probability vector as an array, and me sending you the array with all the probabilities, you know, this could contain a lot of information with 8 real numbers, but you only see 3 bits if I generate this state according to this distribution, and you know, you're welcome to look at it. But you can still do interesting things in this model. Okay, so now to the quantum case. So we have n qubit registers. Oh, by the way, the dimension doesn't necessarily have to be a power of 2. It's just maybe simpler to just speak in that language. But it could be, you could have like a 3-bit register is 8 dimensional, but you could also have a trit register, which is, you know, just 0, 1, and 2, 3 states. And the quantum is a generalization, if you will, or it's a variation of the first, let's think of it as a variation of this notion of a probabilistic state. And I think I'm just going over stuff that we know that instead of associating a probability with 0 and with 1, there's a probability amplitude, or just amplitude. And the rules for amplitudes are different than probabilities. They can be arbitrary complex numbers. They don't have to be non-negative real numbers. And it's just the sum of the absolute values squared that are 1. So this column vector is a unit vector. In a way, geometrically, it's kind of more elegant object. It's a point on the surface of some high dimensional sphere, or of a sphere. In this case, it would be a circle, I guess, but over the complex numbers. And then for three qubits, it's the same thing. It's just eight amplitudes, so it's an eight dimensional unit vector. And we're going to discuss the rules of engagement for setting these bits and processing these states and getting readouts. But let me just pause to say these are all pure states. And the most general notion of a quantum state is a mixed state, which is expressed in terms of density matrices or density operators. How many of you know what density matrix or density operator is? Everybody. Okay, good. We're going to talk about that later, and I don't want to get into that right now. But just for completeness, I'll just say that if we generalize to include mixed states and density operators, then what we really get is what you can think of as a generalization of probability theory, where the classical information theory corresponds to the case where you have restricted operations, so you always have diagonal density matrices, something like that. Okay, the Dirac notation, I'm guessing we know what that is. That's we just use the kets with the labels to denote. If we put a digit, that means it's one of the basis states. And we'll call this, the computational basis, but it's just some special basis. And then, a ket denotes a column vector, and the corresponding bra denotes the conjugate transpose. And, you multiply bra by a ket, it's an inner product. So it's the bracket. So instead of drawing column vectors, we can just express a state like this. Okay. We can set a qubit to a basis state. So ket 0 or ket 1. Process, apply a unitary operation. So dagger is conjugate transpose. And here are some examples. Rotation, the Pauli operators, and then this Hadamard transform, which I'll point out that the Hadamard of ket 0, it produces an equally weighted superposition of 0 and 1. And the Hadamard of 1 produces, it's equally weighted, except you get a minus 1 factor in front of the 1. And this is called the Hadamard basis as opposed to the computational basis. I'm going to try to move a bit faster here. The reading part is to apply what we'll call a standard measurement or a measurement in the computational basis, where when you measure a qubit, you don't get to see the amplitudes, but you get to see as a 0 or 1 with probabilities corresponding to the absolute values of the amplitude squared. And then the state collapses to a computational basis state. So if you measure it again, you don't get anything new. And these aren't all the operations. There are others, and we'll discuss them later. But you can simulate all the operations in terms of these. So, for example, you could consider measuring in some alternate basis, and say, well, how come I'm not allowing that operation? Well, you can simulate that by first performing a unitary transformation to sort of map the green basis to the computational basis, then do a measurement in the computational basis, and then maybe doing the opposite to rotate back. Okay. Distinguishing between two states. So suppose that we played the game where I create a qubit in state either the one of these two Hadamard basis states. We'll call this the plus state or the minus state, and I give it to you, and I ask you, you tell me which one it is. If you're correct, I give you a dollar. If you're wrong, you give me a dollar. So what would you do? I mean, measuring on the computational basis won't work, right? Because you'll get a 50-50 answer each way. Right? This is easy, right? Is it? I hope, yeah. I'm okay. I don't even have to say the answer. Somebody? Maybe somebody should say. What should we do? Measure on the top. Yeah, perform a Hadamard transform that changes this to the, or it's its own inverse, so it changes from the Hadamard to the computational, and then you can do the measurement, you get the answer exactly. Okay, so next slide will be an interesting question if you're really bored by this, or maybe an interesting question. I don't know. We'll see. How about distinguishing between the plus and the zero state? How do we do that? It's the same game. You don't know which one it is. There's a 50-50 chance I created the plus state, 50-50 chance I created the zero state. How are you going to, what measurement should you do? What's the best problem? The plus minus basis?
The minus basis, if I get the positive answer, then it's zero, but I can, if I don't get the result, then I cannot say that it's zero.
Then you don't know, right? So there's no way to get the right answer all the time because the states aren't orthogonal. I mean, that can be, I'm not proving that, but it turns out, so, and I think your method is consistent with that. But it does make partial progress because for one answer, you know you got the right answer. If you measure in the Hadamard basis, that's what you're proposing, correct? But if you get the other answer, then you don't know, and really the best you could do is just guess 50-50. You can always win this game without even looking at that purple box with 50% probability by just guessing. But if you use the method you proposed, you'd get 50% correctness half the time and 100% correctness half the time, so you'd get 75% correctness. So you do get something. Can you do better than 75% for this? Yeah?
I think if you measure it on the basis that's like symmetrically.
Yeah. This one, so you kind of split the difference. This is, I guess, 22.5 degrees and 22.5 degrees. And it turns out if you measure that way, you'll get the answer. I think it's cos squared of pi over 8, which is about 85%. And that's the best you can do. It'll be proven that you can't do better. And a lot of quantum algorithms, which I think you'll see in later sections of this course or later parts, actually involve constructing some interesting state and then doing some measurement that extracts information out of it. So in a way, a lot of what the algorithm is doing is playing a game like this, or at least a piece of the algorithm, but maybe in a more complicated way. Okay, so this is what I said would be maybe a fun question if you're looking for some amusement while I dabble away here. So consider the trine states. So this isn't supposed to be three-dimensional. These are states in two-dimensional space, and they're just 120 degrees apart, these three. And we play the similar game where I generate one of these three states randomly, with probability 1/3 each. And then I construct a qubit in that state, and then I give it to you. And your job is to figure out which of the three I constructed. And again, if you guess right, I give you $1. And if you guess wrong, you give me $10. No, I'm just kidding. So what's the best success probability you can get out of this? For this game. Pardon me? Well, if for 10, yeah, maybe. But at what point? Yeah, I guess there's some break-even point. What if I gave you, if you had to pay me $1.50 when you were wrong, is it worth playing the game then? Okay, well, so what is that probability? Is there a maximum probability you can attain for this? So I'll just leave that up. Maybe tomorrow I'll reveal the answer. There are two ways of thinking about it. It's a little bit tricky depending on what tools you use. There's a way to do this with okay, let me just move on. Okay, so n qubit states, I guess I really gave you the operations on one qubit states, but for n qubit states, it's just n 2 to the n by 2 to the n unitary matrices and measurements. You know, you have 2 to the n amplitudes, and it just collapses to one of those. You get the each outcome occurs with probability the amplitude squared, and then the state collapses to a computational basis state. Okay. And well, there's the structure about subregisters, and again, I have a feeling this is familiar ground. But if you have two qubits, you can think of that as a two-qubit register or two separate one-qubit registers, and it's kind of important to be able to make that distinction. And if we have the states of the individual registers, then we can take the tensor product or Kronecker product of the two two-dimensional vectors, and we get a four-dimensional vector, which corresponds to the state of the joint system. Okay, so we can always do that. If we know the state of the constituents, then we can determine the state of the global state. Let's try to go the other way. So here I'm giving you the states. I'm giving you the global state. And what are the two constituents that give you this global state? You fill in here. If these were all pluses here, then you would just put, 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2, 1 over root 2. Pardon? Okay. Okay. Well, if you set this to 0 plus 1 and this to 0 minus 1, so put a minus 1 here, that'll do the job. But you'll get that if you tensor it out. Okay, what about this one? Yeah? You can't do it, right. And there's a simpler example where the states, in both cases, the states are entangled. In fact, the state is local equivalent to this. So you can't always do that. So in the world of pure states, the individual qubits or the subregisters might not exist in pure states, even though the global system is in a pure state. Okay. So there's this big picture, and Aggie said we should talk about circuits, right? And so let me just get everybody on ground here that if we have, let's say, some number of qubits, let's say 4, then in this framework, what we can do is we can apply, for example, a unitary operation on just the first qubit and leave everything else alone, and then a unitary on the second and third and leave everything else alone. And then the first and second, for example, we can apply unitary operations on various subsets of the qubits. And at the end, this could be one way of denoting a measurement. And then these wires here are the classical outcomes. So you don't have to measure all the qubits, but maybe just some of them. And this makes sense, this kind of operation. And some stuff that's that you see in the diagram that suggests is actually correct, like U and V commute with each other because they're acting on separate qubits, but in general V and W might not commute with each other. Okay, so this is kind of a picture that we get, and then quantum computations. Well, this is what a quantum circuit could look like. We start with some number of qubits in basis states. And then we just apply a number of gates, let's say 2-qubit gates. We want each gate to be some constant cost. And then we measure at the end, and we get our outcome. And you can draw a circuit like this or describe a picture like this that factorizes integers, Shor's famous algorithm. And we can say that we can consider the number of gates to be the cost. Okay, now, it's not so easy to actually build this physically, but at least in principle, it looks like it might be doable. And I think there is going to be some lectures on fault tolerance and error correction that show at least some ways you can get around some of the issues. And the goal is to actually be, in quantum computing, one of the major goals is to build a large-scale quantum computer, which is to simulate a system like this. And let's just go over some of these, some of the mechanics of this. Like, what does it mean if I have a 2-qubit system? So it's a four-dimensional vector, and I apply a unitary just to the second qubit, and I do nothing to the first. What is that operation? So this is a 2x2 unitary, but what's the 4x4 unitary on the global system corresponding to this? Now I know if you've seen this before, this is boring. But you're working on the trine state problem, or you've solved. Anybody solved the trine state problem yet? Okay, but if you have, just in case you haven't seen this before, I'm going over this. The actual, first of all, this is a definition. It's part of the model it's not really deducible from the model, but in a way, it's the only sensible way to think about such an operation. That if the two systems were in a product state, if they were not entangled, like they were in this basis state, they were both in state ket zero, then really you would just act on the second qubit and nothing would happen to the first. So this would become u zero, this would become one, would become u one, et cetera. And this forms the basis for the four-dimensional vectors. And if we sort of demand that this be a linear operator, actually unitary, 4x4 matrix, there's only one that has this property, because we've defined what it does on a basis, so by linearity. And this, it turns out that this is just the tensor product of identity and u. So identity means do nothing, and this means do u. So in general, when you have a unitary acting on a subset of the qubits, you can imagine you're applying identity on the other qubits, and you're just taking their tensor products. Okay? That's clear? All right. So there's another gate that's kind of important here to know, which is what's called the controlled U gate. So again, this is a two-qubit situation or scenario. So we have a U here and acting on one qubit, and then we have this wire here, and it means that it's somehow controlled by this other qubit. And what we mean by that is, if this qubit is in a computational basis state, then ket zero means don't do anything, and ket one means actually do the U. So if this is a computational basis state, then this is controlling whether or not you actually do the U. So this would map basis states in this manner, where when the control qubit is 1, you actually apply u to the other qubit, and when it's 0, you don't. Okay, and this becomes this, it defines this, this is the definition of a controlled u, it's this operator here. It's doing nothing in this case and applying u in this case. Okay? Again, this is a definition, it's not really deducible. And a simple example is a controlled NOT gate, where a NOT is the, I guess I never really said what a NOT is. It's this unitary here. It was on one of the slides, but the poly X. And what that does, it's called the NOT because in the computational basis, it maps 0 to 1 and 1 to 0. And now if we do a controlled NOT, what you're really getting is if A and B are labels that are 0 and 1, then you get the exclusive OR of A and B here. And this is just A. Now, let me ask you a question about controlled U gates. That's call this the control qubit and this the target qubit. Does the control qubit change state? Is it possible for the control qubit to change state if we do a controlled U operation? I mean, certainly the target looks like it's changing. Does the question make sense? Well, I guess I've defined it this way. This is the matrix. And here it doesn't change, right? In these four cases. But does that mean that for any possible state here, the control qubit doesn't change state? Let's say we only consider product states. So no, we don't consider entangled states. But where this isn't necessarily in the computational basis, and nor is this, then is it possible that the control qubit changes in state?
What would be the definition of the control you gave if there was a component state on the first control qubit? Because we said the definition of this control qubit gate is that if we have zero first in the control qubit, then we can do nothing. If we have one, we do something. Apply you.
Right.
So what if we have a combination?
So if we have a, if this is in superposition, how does the definition work? So the definition says, in fact, this is the definition. And so the definition is not as simple as that. And so it's a good point. This is just basically motivation for this definition, which is if you're in a computational basis states, then the definition that you described corresponds to what the operator does. And we also ask that it be linear, like unitary, the whole thing. And that means that if we know what it does on the four basis states, then we can deduce what it does on any linear combination of basis states because by linearity. So linearity plus this property implies that it's this 4x4 matrix. And now this 4x4 matrix makes sense for any two-qubit state. So in fact, the control qubit can change state, and even for the simple controlled NOT gate, where it looks like whatever when this bit is zero, it looks like you just flip this bit, and when this bit is one, you flip the second bit, and when the control is zero, you don't flip the second bit, and it looks like the control is not changing. But that's when A and B are zero and one, so they're computational basis states. It turns out that if you do the controlled NOT gate, if you input Hadamard basis states, then it's not hard to show that if you put the plus state and the minus state here, then the outcome will be a minus state and a minus state. So the control changes because we know that this state is distinguishable from this state. And the target doesn't change. And this is another way to summarize this is by this picture. That if you have a controlled NOT gate, comes up a lot in quantum computing, and you change the basis. Sorry, you conjugate it by Hadamard transforms. Which is like saying we're performing it but in the Hadamard basis. And that's actually equivalent to doing a controlled NOT gate that's upside down. Anyway, this control target inversion property, although it looks like it's just some curiosity that maybe it's why should we care? Am I just bringing this up to maybe to sort of test the definitions a bit? But in fact, quantum algorithms use this, something like this. If you learn about Deutsch's algorithm, it's really much very much based on this kind of property. And even the more sophisticated algorithms, like Shor's algorithm, has something like a generalization of this idea. Okay. So I would like to talk about superdense coding. Or maybe I want to talk about it, I don't know. How many of you heard of superdense coding? And one? Two? Three? Okay, should I talk about superdense coding? You don't want me to. Okay. Or should I move on? Pardon me?
No, we want you to talk.
Okay, I will. Okay, I'm happy to go ahead. I won't run out of slides. So the word super is kind of maybe an exaggeration. But back in the 80s, it was it is an interesting curiosity, and maybe it's kind of one of the first sort of applications of kind of curious things that you can do if you're in a situation where you can play with qubits instead of classical bits. And something that's small enough we can really sink our teeth into, into all the details. So in order to get to that, Maybe it's important to get to consider this question. How much classical information can you store in n qubits? So suppose I had one of these purple USB drives that's stored n qubits, and I think, well, this is a fancy thing because I'm storing qubits. Can I maybe use it to store classical information that's more than n? Maybe I can store exponentially more than n classical bits in n qubits. What do you guys think? Okay. Oh, well, how many classical bits, like, could I store, for example, n squared, like an n squared classical string in n qubits? So I only have an n qubit register. I don't have any more. And I want to stick an n squared. I want to set the state.
Just about storing, not reading.
Oh, I want to be able to read it out at the end. It's like, otherwise, it's, you're not really storing it. It's just kind of disappearing. But let's say store in the sense that so you have n squared, an arbitrary n squared bit string, and you're able to set the state of your n qubit register. I have no idea what state you set it to, and then you give me the device to me, and I'm supposed to be able to somehow measure those n qubits in a way that I can figure out the n squared classical bits that you started with. That's one definition. That's the definition I want to consider here. Like store in a way where you can actually get it back. Okay. I know we think about black holes here, and yeah. But even there, the information comes back, right? You just have to wait a long time. All right. So you need 2 to the n minus 1 complex numbers to store, to describe a state of n qubits. So it looks like it's a lot of information. You need a lot of classical information to describe an n qubit state. So maybe you can store a lot of information, and people have considered various versions of this question. But in fact, you can't get any. You can't even store n plus 1 classical bits in n qubits in the sense that I described. And there's this famous Holovo's theorem. Has that come up? It may come up later on in the course. But it basically says, and in fact, it's amazing because it goes back to 73, that you can't convey more than n classical bits of information in a message of n qubits. And this, in fact, I've given you sort of the simplified description in terms of entropy. If you're really describing information in terms of the Shannon entropy, you can't get any extra kick in terms of Shannon entropy. I'm not going to prove it, but there's maybe just to give some sense about it. Well, there's an easy case, and I'll explain to you why that's not enough to prove the theorem. Suppose that there was some way of storing more than n classical bits in n qubits. Suppose you could store n plus 1. So you would create an n qubit state, give it to me, and then somehow I can measure it and figure out what the I can figure out what those n plus 1 classical bits are. But if I measure it, what am I doing? I'm sort of doing a unitary operation and then measuring in the computational basis, at least the way I described measurements. And all other measurements can be, the more general notion of measurement can be reduced to this. But what do I see when I do the measurement? I see n bits. I see an n bit string. How can I deduce more than n bits from an n bit string? There must be two different n plus 1 bit messages that give me the same n bit string at the end by the pigeonhole principle. Right? So that would kind of seem to suggest that that you can't, one way to imagine that Holovo's theorem must be true. Unfortunately, it's not as simple as that because so I'm just saying that a string of n zeros and ones can't convey more than n bits of information. And it is true if I'm only allowed to use n qubits in my my measurement. But what I could do is the following. I could take those that n qubit state that you send me, and then I could basically pad it with m additional qubits. Let's say I set them all to computational basis state zero. And then I could apply this unitary transformation on the n plus m qubits. And then I could measure that system. And then I would get n plus m classical bits. And now you can no longer say that n plus m classical bits can't convey more than n bits of information. So now there's no longer this trivial argument to rule out the possibility. But nevertheless, it's true that if you did something like this, although you would get n plus m classical bits, there's no way you can do it so that you can deduce more than n bits of information by looking at those n plus m classical bits. Okay, but now it's hard, not so easy to prove. Okay? So with this in mind, superdense coding is, it starts with the following scenario. N, Alice has two classical bits, A and B, A, B, and she wants to convey those two bits to Bob, and she can only send one qubit to Bob. She wants to convey them perfectly. Okay, by Hollabaugh's theorem, it's impossible, right? Okay, well, that's just the prelude. Let's change the scenario a little bit, that Bob can send a qubit to Alice, and then Alice sends a qubit to Bob. Now Alice can convey two classical bits by sending one qubit. The total number of qubits sent is still two. But what's kind of remarkable, at least a little bit remarkable, is that one of the qubits is going the wrong way. You can't do this with classical information. There's no way that you can send me, one bit, and then I can reply by sending you another bit such that you learn two bits of information from me. But with quantum information, actually that qubit that seems to be going in the wrong direction actually can convey information to Bob at the end. So how does this work? So what Bob does is he creates this entangled state. And really, it's a unit vector. So there's a factor 1 over root 2 and 1 over root 2 here. And often we leave that out and just the convention is that states are normalized. It's to reduce clutter. And what Alice does is the following. She has two bits, A and B. If her bit is, if her first bit is 1, then she applies this bit flip, this X operation, poly X. And if it's not 1, then she does nothing. And then she looks at the second bit. And if the second bit is 1, then she applies this poly Z operation, this phase flip, sometimes called, as it's called. And otherwise, she does nothing. So there are four cases. Either she applies X and Z, or she just applies X, or she just applies Z, or she doesn't apply either of them, and she just does the identity. And if you look at what happens to this state under the four different scenarios, these are the four resulting states. So when A and B are both zero, Alice does nothing, so the state remains the same. In this case, she does the phase flip. So this becomes 0, 0, minus 1, 1, and we can consider the other cases. Okay. So Bob creates this two-qubit system. He holds on to one qubit, sends the first qubit to Alice. Alice performs an operation just on the one qubit in her possession. And then the state is one of these four states, and then she sends that qubit back to Bob. And now Bob again has two qubits in his possession. And now his job, if he wants to know what both bits of Alice and Bob are, he just has to be able to perform a measurement that distinguishes among these states. Can Bob do that? These are the Bell basis states. Yeah, they're orthogonal. That's what Bob does. So literally what he does, if he wants to stick to our rules, is he could perform some unitary that maps the computational basis, the Bell basis back to the computational basis. and then he measures. Okay? And that's super dense coding. So maybe, I mean, it's a little bit of a curiosity, and but I think maybe you'll also agree with me that super is maybe, in hindsight, I think this goes back to the 1980s. So.
Is there just regular dense coding?
Pardon me?
Is there regular dense coding?
No. It's and you can't get better than a factor of two. You might think that that somebody would have figured out how to do better than a factor of two, if you want to do it exactly. So anyway, it's just a bit of a curiosity and a game just to get well, let me move on. So actually, I haven't completely defined the model, though, this framework. I defined what it means to perform unitary operations on part of a system, on the subset of the qubits, but I haven't defined what it means to perform a measurement on part of a system. And I don't think I have to spend much time, because I suspect from your background, you may already have a good idea of how this is defined, but let me go through it quickly. What am I doing here? Sorry, this is a recap. This shouldn't even be here. This is some recap, which we don't need. Okay, so let's consider Q-trits, just because I can draw these pictures. Think of this as some three-dimensional scenario where we have three orthogonal vectors, basis vectors, zero, ket 0, ket 1, and ket 2. And a Q-trit is some arbitrary superposition of these, some unit vector in the sort of sphere, the unit sphere here. And normally when we think of measurements, our definition is such that the state will collapse to one of these basis states, and it will collapse to each one with the projection onto that basis state. How big, because this projection is small, it's the square of this projection that's the probability that this is the outcome of that measurement. And this is a larger projection, so this is a larger outcome. That's our framework for measuring. But you can also consider measurements where, you can think of these as three orthogonal one-dimensional subspaces that are the basis axes, but you could have subspaces that are orthogonal of different sizes. So you could have a one-dimensional space, just the ket zero, and you could consider the two-dimensional space spanned by ket two, and the two-dimensional space spanned by ket zero and ket one. And then geometrically, the definition of the measurement with respect to this, so you have a sort of a rank one projector and a rank two projector. What it comes out to is you take your state, and it's the projection onto this space squared that's the probability of this outcome, and the projection onto this space squared that's the probability of that outcome. So the outcome is one of the two spaces. And in this case, the state collapses to ket 2, but in this case, the state collapses to whatever state is the closest in this two-dimensional space, whatever the orthogonal projection is. So you haven't completely destroyed the state, because there could be some interesting superposition between ket 0 and ket 1 if you perform this measurement. Okay? And, oops, so this is, so what you get in this case, for 2, you get alpha 2 times 2, but then you renormalize, so it's just ket 2, and in this case, you get alpha, the alpha 2 goes away, this last term, if it collapses to this two-dimensional space, but this isn't normalized, so you just imagine you divide by the square root of the sum of the squares of the amplitudes. Okay. So, I did this as a lead-up to defining what it means to measure the first qubit of a two-qubit system, and not measuring the other qubit. And it's the same idea where you have these two spaces. You have the one space, which is the span, which is basically all states where the first qubit is in state ket 0, which is the span of 0, 0, and 0, 1. And then there's this other two-dimensional space where the first qubit is in state 1. So these are two-dimensional spaces, and they're orthogonal to each other, and that's possible because they exist in a four-dimensional space. And when you perform this measurement, you're basically just collapsing the first qubit. So you're either collapsing the state to this span of all states where the first qubit is in state zero, or all states where the first qubit is in state one. And then there's this residual state. So it looks like this. I don't know if I'm going too fast or too slow. I think for some of you, I'm going too slow, and some for too fast. So basically, for outcome zero occurs with the probability of this squared plus this squared, and then this is the state you have left, but you renormalize, and then similarly for outcome one. There are sort of two outcomes. There are two qubits left, but the first qubit is just corresponds to what the outcome was, and the interesting qubit is the second one. So you could just kind of say you're only interested in the state of the second qubit. You could discard the first qubit. Okay. Does that make sense, or is that okay? Should I continue? Okay. Good. All right. And you could check that if you it doesn't matter which. According to this definition, it doesn't matter whether you measure the first or the second qubit. You sort of consider the same definition measuring the second qubit. Or if you measure them both at the same time, you get this. The definitions are equivalent. Okay? Teleportation. Now, I'm not supposed to say very much about that, right? I'll go fast. If Alice wants to convey a qubit to Bob, you can't do that. I mean, it's infinitely many classical bits to describe these two real numbers, or these two complex numbers. Oh, so she's only allowed to send classical bits to Bob, and she has a qubit. She might not even know what the state is, because maybe someone else generated and gave it to her, and she doesn't want to start measuring, because then she'll destroy the state. Okay. The thing is that he can actually convey this qubit to Bob, which looks like there's a huge amount of information, but by just sending Bob two classical bits. But they need an extra resource, and you assume that they start with an entangled state. And of course, this entangled state contains no information about the qubit that Alice has. And now Alice only needs to send Bob two classical bits, and then Bob can reconstruct the state. Well, there's a little calculation you could go through with of what we do. Like, this is the state of this. There are three qubits in play here, and this is the initial state. You can multiply this out, this tensor product of this and this. I think I'm just going to skip. Somebody actually wants me to. The details, but this is the initial state written again, and it's expanded out. And you can actually write it in this way in terms of these four terms. And what's interesting is, if you look at it this way, it looks like the alphas and betas are somehow associated with the third qubit, which is Bob's, even though Bob has had no information about the alpha and beta. They're part of this qubit. Now, if Bob just tries to measure the state, he gets no information about alpha and beta, because things are kind of washed out, because in a way you're taking some kind of average. Four cases. But the thing is that Alice can measure her two qubits now in the Bell basis, and it causes the state to collapse to one of these four. And in each of the four cases, Bob essentially has the answer, but there's a correction that needs to be done. Either the sign needs to be changed between plus and minus, or the alpha and beta need to be flipped. So Alice performs a measurement in the Bell basis, causing the state to collapse to one of these four, and then she tells Bob the two classical bits, and then Bob can just do the appropriate correction, and he gets alpha 0 plus beta 1 in all cases. Okay, so you can describe teleportation as a circuit, where we're kind of conveying the fact that this is Alice's world. This time is going left to right, of course. This is Alice's world, and this is Bob's world, and here she's sending the two classical bits over to Bob's world. So, it's helpful. You can go through this circuit and just confirm that it does the teleportation correctly. And Alice loses her copy of the state when she does this. All right. No cloning. What's this about? So you can normally we copy information all the time, right? I always have backups of things, and with quantum information, you can't You can't really do that. So here's a one-bit cloner, just this controlled NOT gate. These sort of thick double lines mean it's classical information. But there's no unitary that'll take a qubit. It's an arbitrary qubit state. And this think of this as the blank piece of paper, this ket zero state. And it goes through this unitary, and you get two copies of whatever this state was. If you try to use the controlled NOT gate, that works for basis states, for computational basis states, but it doesn't work for the Hadamard basis states. It produces this state. It's the output where the two qubits are entangled. But if you wanted two copies of these plus states, then you know the correct answer would be this, and that's not what you get. So let's quickly sketch a proof of the no cloning theorem. And the proof, I mean, let's consider, actually I'm considering a little bit more here in this proof. So here's the state that we're presumably cloning by some unitary operation. And this is the qubit that's going to be transformed to the second copy of the state. But I'm also allowing an additional qubit, maybe several more qubits. So I think this could be more than a qubit register, but I'm just drawing it this way. And this could be just some extra stuff that you put in, and then some garbage state that you get out that you just sort of throw in the throw away. Does there exist a unitary in this framework that would produce two copies of an arbitrary one qubit state? Is the question clear? And to prove that you can't do this, consider two states, psi and psi prime. And if such a unitary existed, then unitaries preserve the angles between vectors, the inner products between vectors. So if this is psi is the input, then the output would be psi, psi, and then some garbage state, g. And if psi prime is the input, then the output would be two copies of psi prime, and then maybe a different garbage state, g prime. And if such a unitary existed, then the inner product between this and this, the input states, and this, would be the same. Right? So I'm just writing out what it means. I mean, if the inner products are the same, because these are tensor products, the inner product of this and this is this, we would have this equation. And you just factor the psi prime, get psi prime on one side, and you look at this, and the only way this can be zero is if this inner product is zero or one. So either the two states have to be orthogonal, in which case we know we can clone in that case, because it's like cloning basis states, or they have to be the same state. It's also easy. Okay. Classical versus quantum circuits. Here's some classical logic gates, not. In fact, you can simulate an OR gate by De Morgan's law in terms of AND gates and NOT gates. And this is the olden days. They used notation like this when people thought of in the electronics community, and then this is a more modern notation for these logic gates. And this is a classical circuit, where we have the data going in.
When did they start using the more modern notation?
Good question. When I was an undergrad here.
Really?
Yeah. That long ago, yeah.
Like when we learned the stuff in school, it's still in the old notation.
Oh, I see. Well, it depends which book.
Australia, yeah.
Well, it depends which book, I guess. Yeah.
What's the advantage of this? You know?
Well, it's just obvious what the gates are. If you know these, I guess if you know this means not and this means and, then it's immediate if you're in logic. But if you don't, then there's no advantage. This one is sometimes I forget which is the and which is the or, because the or has its own funny shape. Anyway, it doesn't really matter. It's not important. I have no strong feelings about any notation here. So in fact, classical computations can be viewed in this manner. And even though a classical computer is not necessarily, I don't really mean a physical device that actually has wires kind of doing something like this and the data flowing through it, because we think of this as a time dimension, and that these are just the cube, these are just the bits, and then just at the first time you're performing these operators, but it's the same, some subset of qubits. Yeah, so think of this as a world line, if you will, or a time dimension, not as something you would necessarily physically construct and string together, although you could. And any classical algorithm, you can abstract out to something like this, and the number of these gates would somehow correspond to the cost of the algorithm, the number of elementary operations. Yes?
What's the end of three things?
Oh, yeah, sorry. So there's a fan out here that you're allowed to do, which means that you can actually take whatever this bit is, and you can feed it in here, and you can feed another copy in here, and feed another copy here. With classical information, you can clone. So there's a theorem that says that you don't really have to have fan out more than two. You can, without any real loss of efficiency, you can just assume the fan out is two. But there's sort of cloning implied here. In the quantum case, we kind of line things up nicely, partly because we want to do reversible operations, unitary operations. So we have the same number of inputs and outputs going into each gate. This is this quantum circuit picture I drew before. And so multiplication, here's two numbers. This is 7, and that's 5 in binary. This is 35, computing the product. And you learned in grade school, I think they still teach it in grade school, or they did when you were in grade school. They haven't stopped teaching it yet. An algorithm that probably scales n squared if you're multiplying two n-digit numbers. Okay? I mean, you could do, you probably learned it in binary, decimal, not in binary, but you could, if I gave you 200-digit numbers, you could, in principle, compute their product. You wouldn't want to, but you know the method. You could do the algorithm by hand. But it scales n squared. And there are better algorithms that scale better than n squared. And the best is it's just slightly worse than n log n. For a long time, it was n log n log log n, which is a very slowly growing function, but it's actually n log n times something that's 2 to the log star n, which is, for all practical purposes, a constant. What is log star? Does anyone know what log star is? So you know that log is just the inverse of the exponential function, right? So you have this function that maps n to 2 to the n, much larger than n, and going backwards is the logarithm function, like the pre-image of this. Think of the another function, which is kind of a tower of n's, where you map n to 2 to the 2 to the 2. We have n of these. And this exponentiation associates to the right. I mean, this is really big. Like, for n equals 5, this is bigger than probably any numbers that came up in cosmology and at this institute. So the inverse is the function that maps this to this. Okay, so theoretically this goes to infinity as n approaches infinity, but in practice it's never more than 5. Probably never going to be more than 5. Anyway, n log n, it's approximately linear in n is the cost. And with quantum computers, we don't know how to make a dent in this. We can't do multiplication faster. But factoring problem, as I think everybody, I'm sure everybody knows, is going backwards, where you're given the product, say 35, and you want to find the factors. And again, you knew in grade school how to factor by a trial division method, and that's slightly better than 2 to the n. If you just try all possible divisors, you can stop when you get to the square root of the number. So it's 2 to the n over 2. And then there are better algorithms that are about 2 to the cube root of n for factoring on classical computers, but it's this is essentially exponential or somehow morally equivalent to growing exponentially fast. And it's so much presumed to be hard that much of classical public key cryptography has been based on the presumed hardness of doing this and the fact that if you can scale n to a few thousand, this number is too large to factor, like the RSA crypto system. And there's this famous quantum algorithm of Shor, which you'll probably hear something about later on in the course, that scales about quadratically. It's actually, there's some logs here, but it's about quadratically. So you could break RSA with a quantum computer, if we had a quantum computer. Okay, quantum circuits and classical circuits. Here's a 3-qubit gate. It's like a controlled knot, where in the computational basis, if both of these controls are one, then you negate C. There's the unitary matrix for that kind of identity here, and then this little not gate, little corner in the not, which is like a not gate. And if you have gates like this, you can simulate an AND gate, because you set the target to zero, and then this becomes the AND, and then you can just throw this out. You might not want to just throw it out. You might want to clean up this garbage, because you can get unwanted entanglement. But you can imagine, you can at least, I'm just trying to show that you can simulate a classical computer with a quantum computer. Even though the AND gate is not a reversible gate, you can simulate it with reversible gates. And NOT gates are very easy. And since all logic gates can be converted into AND gates and NOT gates efficiently, we're done. Except we're not quite done, because you can use probabilistic methods and algorithms. But with a quantum computer, that's no problem at all, right? To simulate a coin flip, you just apply a Hadamard to zero and measure. You get a coin flip. I mean, you get the randomness. It's kind of baked into the whole framework of quantum information. If you don't want to do these measurements, there are other tricks you can do where you don't actually measure, but you do something else. Which I think I'll skip over. And simulating quantum circuits with classical circuits, well, you can do that too. Only problem is it's not very efficient. And I won't go through this whole thing. I don't know if these slides are going to be made available or. But I'm also happy to, anybody wants after class or now, just can demand more details. But it's just that I'm afraid of boring you. The basic idea is to just use an array for an n-qubit system, a 2 to the n, an array of size 2 to the n to store the amplitudes. And whenever there's a gate, you just update this array. So it's kind of a brute force simulation. And you can do that. And you you get some something that's exponential in... At the cost of one exponential, you can simulate a quantum computer with a classical computer. So, for example, a quantum computer can't solve the halting problem. Because if you could, then you could solve the halting problem with a classical computer. You know, it can't solve undecidable problems. It's just the efficiency. It's just this one exponential gain in efficiency. I say just. It's a big thing. But okay. Some complexity classes, so there's polynomial time, and so we have these sort of capture these different resource costs. So polynomial time is usually considered to be what you can solve efficiently on a computer, and there may be some arguments, because what does it mean if it's polynomial time, but it's n to the 200? It's not going to be very practical, even when n is 2. But in practice, this kind of works well. You can also consider an exponential time algorithm that's whose running time is 1.0000001. to the n. And sure, that scales exponentially, but it's probably going to be pretty good for many values of n. So it's a trade-off between what works nice theoretically and what works well in practice, because it's nice to work with this notion of polynomial, because you can compose algorithms that are polynomial time, and you get another polynomial time algorithm. And in practice, things usually, weird stuff like this doesn't tend to happen, including these really ridiculously large exponents. So this is this. These are these definitions in theoretical computer science that have tended to work well as the kind of placeholders for different resource costs. And BPP is just, it's called bounded error probabilistic polynomial time, which is just considering polynomial time, but where you can use classical randomness. And there's some problems that you can solve in bounded error probabilistic polynomial time, but no one knows how to do deterministically in polynomial time. And then BQP is the quantum analog of that, where you have quantum computers. And then here's exponential time. And well, there are thousands. There's this website, the Complexity Zoo, that keeps track of them. I mean, maybe there are more than you think should be studied. But these are some basic classifications, kind of taxonomy of computational problems. I'll point out something that you may find a little disturbing, that I'm considering one of these algorithms successful if the error probability is at most a quarter. So imagine a self-driving car, right? Probability of making a terrible mistake is at most a quarter. Why is that done? Well, it's done because if you can get the error probability down to a quarter, then you can just repeat the algorithm many times and you can amplify it so that the error probability is exponentially small. So you might have to increase the constant here instead of C plus one, an extra factor of n, and then you can make the error probability exponentially small. And at some point, you don't really care. Because if the error probability is, 1 over 20 million, well, if there's going to be a problem, it probably will be a hardware fault or something else, rather than actually being unlucky in terms of the choice of randomness. In fact, if you've ever flown, probably most people here have flown on a commercial airliner. That's the risk that you take, something like 1 in 20 million when you get on a plane. So in practice, it's not something to really worry about. Okay, so I wanted to mention this because this is this kind of a very quick bird's eye view of computational complexity, where we have these classes. There's polynomial time with randomness, exponential time, polynomial space. That's something else where you use, you can run in exponential time, but your memory is constrained to be polynomial. It turns out that that's a subclass of exponential. So these are all contained in each other. And maybe you've heard of NP. That's somewhere here. I'll refer to that later. But let me say what the state of computational complexity is. It's believed that probably all these classes are different than each other. It's known that P and X are not the same. But we don't know that P space and X are not the same, and we don't know that BQP and P space are not the same, and we don't know that this. We know that one of these four containments has to be proper, but we don't know of any particular one that is proper. It's very hard to prove these separations among these complexity classes. So it's possible that everything in P space, which includes everything in NP, is solvable in polynomial time. Probably not. And P-space contains this quantum computing class. So it's possible that there's a classical algorithm that efficiently simulates quantum computers. The algorithm that I gave you a few slides ago just might not be the best one. It's kind of the brute force algorithm. Maybe somebody here will discover an efficient way to do it, and it will kill the Institute for Quantum Computing. It's okay. It'll be great for your career. But anyway, we just want to understand. That's what's important. But it's very hard to prove that things are not equivalent to each other. I would say that maybe some people think we're on the verge of proving P is not equal to BPP, meaning that you can always, whatever you can do with randomness, you can simulate without randomness efficiently. Seems to be evidence that in all other cases, the classes are different from each other. And NP, well, NP actually, it contains P, and it's in P space, but it's incomparable to BQP and BPP. It kind of doesn't really look well in this picture. I guess it would be a circle that would be contained in this circle, or in this oval, and it would contain this oval, this circle, and it would just not, there'd be no containments among these. Okay, and if you haven't heard of NP, then don't worry about it. We could talk about density matrices, but I'm kind of close to the end, and I want to get some feeling for what I should talk about next time. I'll give the solution to the. Has anybody solved the trine measurement problem?
I did. Just ask square root of 3 divided by.
Two plus square root of 3 divided by what?
6.
Divided by 6, and roughly what is that in decimal? I don't know. I don't think that's right. It could be. It's between 0 and 1, right? It's so that's the claimed answer. I'll leave you in suspense.
0.622.
So that's a pretty good method. Turns out you can do better. I'll say that. But it's a pretty good method. I'll explain that. But maybe the best use of the just a few minutes left is to figure out what to talk about next time. I could go through the density matrices, but I don't know. Maybe you already know density matrices. Okay. So then I won't. Let's just see what else is coming up. Channels, the Krauss Steinspring and Steinspring representation of channels. Okay. LVMs, I guess. I think I might be done. Yeah. Well, maybe this is something interesting. Bell's theorem.
No.
Wait, what?
Not again.
Not again. Okay. All right. Oh no. Okay, well, I had some fun stuff to talk about that. Let's see. The GHZ, did you know the GHZ paradox? Kind of easier to explain than it's essentially like Bell's theorem.
Oh,
maybe I had some fun out of it. All right. Some Bell's inequality and da 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 da.
Yeah, I mean, at least in the quantum mechanics.
Have you seen it? How about communication complexity? How about quantum fingerprinting? Have you heard of that?
I think we haven't heard anything about computation.
Okay. It's communication. Maybe I'll do some of this stuff. But I'm also happy to, Aggie, you can make suggestions. Feel free, because I think you know what's, you have the best sense of what people have and don't have.
Yes,
or what will already be covered. So I don't want to write down a list.
Yeah, so Debbie's going to cover...
data compression.
Okay.
Then we will cover quantum error correction.
Okay.
And the optical implementations.
Okay.
A little bit of quantum algorithms. And
who's covering quantum algorithms?
Kayla.
Oh, okay.
And relativistic quantum. A little bit on cybersecurity. I think it'd be interesting to see in detail things like how you do reverse gate, using like putting in a register, and so you mentioned that there's tricks for, let's say, you're going to do the end gate.
Yeah.
There's tricks for getting the stuff in the detail.
Okay. So, for example, there's a result that says that if you have an arbitrary n qubit unitary. So it's a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix, then you can always express it in terms of at most order 4 to the n 2-qubit gates. And that's a lot of gates, but that's actually the best you can do in general. Would people want to see that? I could say a little bit about that.
Yeah, so that's...
how to decompose unitaries into 2-qubit gates, arbitrary unitaries.
Yeah, I think that
would be. Okay. All right. That's one thing. Anything else?
How to throw away jump bits.
Oh, how to, okay. Yeah. How to clean up garbage.
Yeah.
Sure. Yeah, I can do that. well, this is for myself. Anything else? Okay. Yeah, okay, sure.
I don't know if there's
any of you guys have heard about all of that. Can we? Well, I don't know if it's more of like a physics thing, but if you go up, someone can do topological.
I probably couldn't do that very well. That's a good idea. I mean, it's a nice idea, but not for me. Anything else?
So we're gonna like cover quantum algorithms at some point.
We will have some. Yeah, Michael also won't cover quantum
algorithms. Oh, there's some people coming bearing down on us. So.
What about communication conflict?
Pardon me?
So what about communication conflict?
Yeah, I'll include that also. Okay. Okay. Okay, that is part of it. And what I'll just do is I'll just go to the my very first slide. How do I do that? Sorry, one, enter. There's my email. You could send me something. And I might not be able to cover what you want or something, or I might use the blackboard or something, but don't. It's okay to make suggestions. It may be something that I already have slides for. So I'm going to probably leave at about 3:45 today because I got a meeting. If anybody wants to chat, but tomorrow I'll be around more. I'll come earlier and I can stay later. Okay. So thank you very much for your attention.